Hello, this is Roy Thomas, and you're listening to the Power Cosmic Podcast.
That's right, friends. You've been waiting for the podcast that talks about the things you love. Well, go no further, because you've reached the Power Cosmic Podcast. Each week, legendary Comic-Con promoter Mitch Halleck of the Terrific Con and legendary finder of lost things John Cimino of Saturday Morning Collectibles at the Raynham Flea Market, booth A89 and 90, will talk about the stuff you love. Now sit back and talk about comics, TV, movies, toys, and more. It's the Power Cosmic Podcast.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's a sad day here at the Power Cosmic. Not really a sad day, but maybe a day of or a life celebrated.
Sunday.
What?
It's Sunday.
It is Sunday, but we're doing a special recording here because just on Friday, the news came that all Marvelites and Marvel Zombies feared that would happen one day, and I called you or texted you. I can't remember. I think I texted you.
Yeah, you contacted me. That's right.
And I said, hey, Ditko's dead. It came across the wire. I think Scott Tucky texted me the link that said that he died at age 90, actually a couple days prior to Friday. And that was it. Died in his apartment in New York City.
Who died, Mitch? You didn't say anything.
Oh, geez, I thought we were already talking. Steve Ditko. How could I be remiss? The co-creator of Spider-Man and so many other characters out there. The Blue Beetle. The Creeper,
Doctor Strange,
some of the Marvel ones I'm thinking of. Oh, Machine Man. I think that was him, or was that a Kirby guy?
No, that was Kirby. That was Kirby.
Oh, all right. But I thought he did a miniseries. Anyway.
Yeah, he did the miniseries, but I think Machine Man, did he come in like 2001?
Yeah, he was in there somehow. Story. Anyway, we're all over the place already within 2 minutes of it, but let's go back and trace the history of Steve Ditko, one of the early Marvel pioneers alongside Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Flo Steinberg. Can't even think of some of the, I guess, out of the original
original bullpen.
Yeah, and he started working on a lot of those horror books. I think he probably did the Western books, but those sci-fi fantasy books, that's what caused him to be working on the Amazing Fantasies 15, The Birth of Spider-Man, because he had already been assigned to that book. I got a couple of those issues prior to that, and it had Ditko's art. He always had like the 50s style, you know, when men were walking around with the hats and the coats and the vests and stuff. Everybody looked very, very late 50-ish, early 60s, you know?
Yeah.
He had a distinct style.
Yeah, I got more 50s with Ditko's, like the bow ties and stuff.
Yeah. And when they would draw Peter Parker over at the Daily Bugle, and everybody always had that yellow vest with the little red bow tie. You're right. Yeah. They did pick up on that bow tie when Romita took over. But, yeah, Ditko had it down packed. And he had that very clean advertising agency 50s style type of thing, I'm going to say, like a retro feel.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people don't know this, but he wrote most of those early Spider-Mans. That's what the story is. I know Stan scripted them all, but he came up a lot with the plot lines and the Green Goblin. And wasn't it him the one that came up with the idea of who the Green Goblin was going to be? Or he wanted
to keep it? That was the real end, almost the bitter end of Stan and Ditko, which was, Ditko wanted it to be just an anonymous person, but Stan wanted it to be the Green Goblin because it made more sense, you know, with the whole drama and the whole teen angst thing.
Yeah.
To put it all together. And if you ask me, Stan was right. Though Ditko didn't like that because logically, why would it be him? It could have been anybody. But for story purposes, you got to give it, for me, I got to give it to Stan on that one because it's just, it makes all that drama.
Yeah, more soap opera, like, you know, my best friend's dad is the villain that's trying to kill me. But what was the other guy's name? He had the Enforcer. Wasn't there like a crime lord guy?
That he had that metal face?
Yeah, I can't think. Was it the Rose? No, not the Rose. That came later on. There's a character he came up with that was bothering like Ned Leeds. He was like this big time gangster. The Enforcer? Was that what it is? No. God, it got me. I'm going to have to look it up. He had some character That was like a crime boss that was leading all the stuff for the first 20 issues or so.
Yeah, I think I remember. I remember what you said, but I haven't. Jesus, to be honest, I haven't read those Spider-Man comics, which is the only Spider-Man omnibus I own is the Steve Ditko Stan Lee one. That was really, really good.
Yeah. It'll come to me. Like I said, that's the stuff you read when you were a kid. I remember getting into Spider-Man, and you would find those old collections, like the Marvel Treasuries, and they would reprint the Steve Ditko stories, the Marvel Tales, that type of thing. So
now, I'm going to say something. Like, I was never a big Steve Ditko fan, and I'll tell you why. I got into Steve because when I was young in the 80s, and his art was already passé. But when I looked at those old tales, like Marvel Tales and stuff, I loved his Spider-Man. You could tell he was just on point. He was at his peak and prime at those. And I, till this day, I still love those Spider-Mans. I thought his Spider-Mans were the best. And I know Doctor Strange is huge, too, which was a big influence on the counterculture. But I loved his Spider-Mans. And I learned Spider-Man on back. But his 80s stuff, I think he was already gone by then.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think. I know we did Squirrel Girl was another one. I just looked it up. But don't you hear Steve Ditko? I mean, he's known to shy away from the public, what do you want to say, outside of the comic book world. Yeah, he didn't go to conventions.
His first thing out in public, he did the 1964 Comic-Con, and people described him as timid, sweating, and kind of distant, if I can remember correctly. But he just had a weird quirk about him, and he vowed never to do it again, and he never did. And a man of his word, Steve Ditko will never change. You know, he was always what he said is he done, and he never did a convention again.
Yeah, and it's funny, years later I wrote to him and I asked him innocently enough, more like a fan, that if he ever had any interest in doing a convention, would he come out to Connecticut? Because he didn't live that far away. He was in New York. And he actually wrote me back within like 3 or 4 days. I remember getting the mail, and I was like looking in the corner to see the addresses. And I see this envelope, and it's in pencil. And it says Ditko in the corner. I'm like, what? And I ripped it open, and sure enough, there was a letter in there on like white typewriting paper, and it was written in pencil. And he wrote to me, and he said, you know, thank you for your invitation. However, it is not my, I have to find the letter, but to sum it up, it was like, I don't look in the past, and while I'm, you know, delighted to hear people enjoy my previous work, I don't really want to talk about it, but, you know, it's amazing how these conventions are going so strong, and people really, enjoy it, but I have no interest whatsoever in discussing my past work or something. But, you know, take care.
It's amazing. When I send Ditko my letter about the Ben Koopa Spider-Man costume and try to get some info on that, he mailed that thing back to me literally by the end of the week. There it was. I was like, just like you, like, holy shit. I was like, Jesus, this is Steve Ditko letter.
Yeah.
Did you send a self-addressed stamped envelope?
No, I didn't send a self-addressed stamped envelope. I just wrote him a normal letter, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of rare. I did, because you want to make sure you get it back, because, you know, I've heard.
I know a lot of people do that when they went. I wasn't asking for an autograph or anything. I was just a simple correspondence with the guy, you know?
Yeah, and basically me too, but it's like, yeah, he wrote in the simple paper and in the pencil, and it's like, you know, no big deal to him.
No. And he did a lot of work besides that. So he goes, does he go from Spider-Man to Doctor Strange, or was he doing both of them at the same time?
Because
I know he eventually leaves Doctor Strange, because Stan announces that in one of those early college campus tours that Stan would take. And that's on recording somewhere. There's an interview with Stan, and he goes, one of our artists, Steve Ditko, has just left Doctor Strange, because Doctor Strange was huge popular on the college campuses because it was so far out. Yeah, with all the, you know, the cosmic stuff and this.
And you know what's funny about that? All the hippies that loved his stuff, and they used it for, like, you know, all their the Kool-Aid, you know, all their trippy stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The funny thing is, Ditko never did a drug in his life, and they all thought that, you know, maybe Ditko was this big druggy counterculture pop icon, and the truth was, he wasn't. He was a conservative.
Yeah.
And he was like, like I said, he didn't ever do drugs and all that stuff. He believed.
He just used his imagination. I mean, you know, that always gets me sometimes too when I hear people like the Beatles were this and that. I'm like, you know, maybe I firmly believe that the drugs didn't create those amazing stories or lyrics or whatever it is. It's just something you have inside of you, and maybe you just can't get to it as easily as you know other people can. But he left. I'm trying to trace back his history. Now, I know it, but I don't know it verbatim. He leaves Marvel, and then he goes over to DC or Charlton Comics. I think maybe Charlton Comics, right?
Yeah, I think Charlton, and that's where he comes up with the Beetle, right?
Yeah, the Blue Beetle, the Question, Captain Atom. He was doing a pile of stuff for them over there. And just trying to think of some of them. Those books, I mean, I have a bunch of those. They weren't very expensive because it's a Charlton book. But he would do it like Mr. A is based on, or is it The Question? I think it's Mr. A. It's all based on that whole philosophy of objectivism that he was a devout believer of.
Yeah, Ayn Rand, right? Ayn Rand?
Yeah, was it Atlas Shrugged? Is that the book that comes from?
Yeah, and Fountainhead.
Fountainhead, that's it. Yeah, yeah. And what? Tell us a little bit about that. What is that belief or whatever?
Okay, don't quote me on this, but objectivism is basically, well, let me look at Ditko's philosophy. It's like, I think it's all based in, like, reality. And, like, you know, Ditko was a big guy for, like, his work represents him. He doesn't represent his work, you know?
Right.
And so, like, that's that. He's a big advocate of that. Like,
so it's more of like a modest thing. You don't take.
Why don't you? Are you at your computer?
Yeah, I'm going to look it up while you start giving me your theories. Because I've had other people tell me something about, like, I had it described to me as like there's a tree, and the wind is blowing against the tree, and the tree's still standing. But is that because of the strength of the tree or the wind? And I was like, what are you talking about?
It's very reality-based. You know, Ditko was a no-nonsense guy where, like, you know, the truth was, I guess that's another way of saying it. It's like, what was truth? Like, that there is, like, a certain truth, and you always adhere to that. But like I said, I'm kind of jumbling that. And I'm sure there's a quote.
No, here, I just did a quick Google search on it. Again, it's not the best, but it says really briefly, objectivism is a philosophical system developed by Russian-American writer Ayn Rand, 1905 to 1982. Rand first expressed objectivism in her fiction, most notably Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. It's going on about it. Okay. It is, that reality exists independently of consciousness. Human beings have a direct contact with reality through perception, that one can attain objective knowledge from perception through the process of concept formation and inductive logic, that the proper moral purpose of one's life is the pursuit of one's own happiness, rational self-interest, that the only social system consists with this morality is one that displays full respect for an individual rights embodied in laissez-faire capitalism, and that the role of art in human life is to transform humans' metaphysical ideas by a selective reproduction of reality into the physical form, a work of art that one can comprehend, to which one can respond emotionally. Huh. That's a lot. But
I think a lot what I said, it's like based on absolute truth, but to the individual person, because I watched a lot of those Ayn Rand videos on YouTube and all that stuff. She's fascinating. I think she makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen any of those.
No, I haven't.
I remember when she was old on Oprah too, and they got into like a little spiff. She was a pistol. She really had that. And it was about finding your own individual truth. So your truth is not my truth, but it is the truth to the individual. Do you get it?
Yeah, I guess so. There's a quick quote in here, too, as I'm reading this. It says, this is from Ayn Rand. My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute. Okay.
Right. It's like, that's what I'm saying. It's like absolute truth. That's when you have absolute truth, you find the reasoning, and you find like your it's almost like finding your heart. It's like, that's what, okay, let's go in Ditko's terms. Like, his art was his absolute truth. That was his genius. And that's why he was so adamant of that representing him. You don't need to know the man. You need to know his art. And that shows you who he is.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I think he was always, like, one never to do autographs or accept tributes or accolades. Because he's like, that's the art. The work speaks for itself, basically, to sum it up.
Right. And that's his absolute truth. Like, you want to know me? Look at that. There you go.
Yeah, you don't need to have an interview with me. You don't need to sit there and question me about this or that, because it's already done. It's there for you.
Correct.
So. All right. And then, so that ties into a lot of his stuff. And I'm trying to go back into some of his other work here as we go back about it here. Steve Ditko also worked on a lot of DC characters as well, and one of them was the Creeper, Hawk, yeah. And Dove, which was a 60s creation. Here we go. Characters created by Steve Ditko. There's a lot. Well, if you consider all the villains in Batman, I mean Spider-Man, he's got this page here. Has Betty Brant, has the Chameleon, has the Crime Master. That's the guy I was trying to think of before, Crime Master. Dr. Octopus, Mary Jane, pretty much anybody that they consider in those Spider-Man books was a creation of his. But other books that he worked on was, let's see, The Question, Shade the Changing Man. I remember that.
Yeah.
Static. He created Speedball, that character for Marvel.
Yeah.
He did something called Terror, which I don't know what that is. Odd Man Comics. A lot of these I just don't know. He said he does the Hulk, but he only did... Didn't he do the Hulk story when he meets Tyrannus and they're down with the Mole Man?
Was that... No. He did one that... He did an annual... Well, first off, he did Hulk number 6, and then when...
Which
when
is Stan, the Tyrannus, the blonde hair guy, right?
No, it was... Oh, yeah. No, the Metal Master. It was the Metal Master.
Oh, okay.
Tyrannus was issue 5, but that was Kirby. But then, to kind of make it cohesive, when the Hulk went back into his own series and into Tales to Astonish, Ditko drew the Hulk. He was drawing the Hulk. And then Ditko came back in the 80s where he did, I remember he did a Hulk annual against Jack Frost. And see, that was my first, discovering of Ditko. And I wasn't really too fond of it at all. I couldn't like the perspective of his fists and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And his Hulk was always a little in the Tales to Astonish. He was very manly. He wasn't, you know, Kirby's was more grotesque, more brutish. The Hulk's with Ditko's looks like he had like nice hair, like, you know, yeah. He combed his hair in the morning.
Well, it's interesting here for somebody who didn't do interviews. There's a whole bunch here on this Wikipedia page where he did talk to some people originally. It said, Ditko also recalled, I don't know who he's talking to, that one of the things I did was to work up a costume. He's talking about Spider-Man. A vital visual part of the character, I had to know how he looked before I did any breakdowns. For example, a clinging power, so he wouldn't have hard shoes or boots. A hidden wrist shooter versus a web gun and holster. I wasn't sure Stan would like the idea of covering the character's face, but I did it because it hid an obvious boyish face. It would also add mystery to the character. Much earlier, in a rare, contemptuous account, Ditko described his and Lee's contributions in a mail interview with somebody named Gary Martin, published in Comic Fan Issue 2 in summer of 1965. Stan Lee thought of the name of the character. I did the costume, the web gimmick on the wrists, and spider signal. He added he would continue drawing Spider-Man if nothing better comes along. The same year, he expressed to the fanzine called Voice of Comicdom regarding a poll of best-liked fan-created comics. It's a shame, Ditko says, since comics themselves have so little variety of stories and styles that you would deliberately restrict your own creative efforts to professional comics. It's a shallow range. What is best liked by most readers is what they are most familiar with and seen in any policy based on a reader's likes has to end up with a lot of look-alike scripts. You have a great opportunity to show everyone a whole new range of ideas of unlimited types of stories and styles. Why flub it? I guess he wasn't too thrilled with the comics and such.
Like I said, the thing with Ditko, he did his own thing. Like, he didn't, and he didn't care what anybody said. And then he had that problem with Stan when, I don't know if you ever saw that Searching for Stan, Searching for Steve Ditko.
Yeah.
That was that documentary, and Stan Lee said that he considered, you know, he wrote up that letter and he said he considered Steve a co-creator. And Steve got pissed at that because he said that he used the word considered. And it wasn't good enough. And then Stan just said it's too much. Now, I look at it this way. He's a co-creator, and that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
For Spider-Man. So, Ditko has his reasons. Stan Lee has his.
So, yeah, no, I was just reading some more quotes about this guy. I mean, there's a lot going on here. It says here, Steve Ditko contributes some of the most surrealistic work to the comic book field, and give its disorienting, hallucinogenic quality. Doctor Strange's adventures take place in a bizarre world of twisting dimensions that resembles a Salvador Dali painting. Inspired by Pulp Fiction magicians of Stanley's childhood, as well as contemporary beat culture, Doctor Strange remarkably predicted the youth counterculture fascination with Eastern mysticism and psychedelia. Never mind that Marvel's more popular or accessible characters, Doctor Strange still found a niche among an audience seeking a challenging alternative to more conventional superheroes. Bum, bum, bum. So then it goes on. Yeah, here he goes. Yeah, he leaves Marvel and goes over to Charlton, it says, in 1966. And he worked there for a couple years. And he also worked on stories here with Archie Goodwin. In 1967, Ditko gave his objectivist ideas the ultimate expression in the form of Mr. A, a published in Wally Wood's independent title called Wit's End, Issue 3. Ditko's hard line against criminals was controversial, as he continued to produce Mr. A stories in one-pagers until the end of the 1970s. Ditko returned to Mr. A in 2000 and in 2009. In 1968, Ditko moved over to The Creeper in Showcase Issue 73, and executive Paul Levitz observed that Ditko's art and The Creeper stories made them look unlike anything else being published at DC at the time. Ditko then co-created Hawk and Dove with Steve Skeets. At the same time, he penciled some stuff for Wally Wood, blah, 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 and it goes on and on and on. And then he says he worked on a backup story called Killjoy, which ran for Charlton in the back of E-Man Comics. Later they... Oh, okay, here we go. Ditko returned to Marvel in 1979, taking over Jack Kirby's Machine Man, which we mentioned. Then he drew the Micronauts. He drew Captain Universe. I remember those. Starting in 1984, he did some backup stuff on ROM, a Godzilla story by Marv Wolfman, Dragon Lord, Speedball, co-created with Tom DeFalco. And then he worked on Pacific Comics, and he did a character that appeared in the back of Pacific Presents. Da, da, da. Then he went back. Wow, he keeps coming back to Marvel. 92, he comes back with writer Will Murray to create Squirrel Girl. And then he's doing more. He worked on Power Rangers. He worked on Indiana Jones. A lot of stuff. He seems to do a lot, you know? He did his own little comics. As of 2012, Ditko continued to work in his Manhattan Midtown West studio. He declined interviews and public appearances in 1969. He said, when I do a job, it's not my personality that I'm offering to the readers, but my work. It's not right. What I'm like that counts. It's what I did and how well it was done. I produce a product, a comic art story. Steve Ditko is the brand name. However, he did continue to contribute numerous essays to Robin Snyder's fanzine called The Comics. Oh, maybe we should get some of those. He had a nephew who was also named Steve Ditko, who became an artist. Oh, that's interesting.
Correct. Was he an artist? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it says, as far as known, he's never married, has no surviving children at the time of his death. Will Eisner stated that Ditko had a son out of wedlock, but this may have been confused as a reference to his nephew that had the same name.
Interesting.
Yeah, this was just updated. Apparently, it said Ditko was found unresponsive in his apartment in New York City on June 29th. Police said he had died 2 days previous. He was pronounced dead at the age of 90. The cause of death initially deemed as a result of myocardial infarction, which basically is a heart attack, brought upon by arthritis, cardiovascular. He had heart disease. He was 90 years old. I mean, you're going to die of something at that point.
Well, I mean, it's sad, but like, let's put it in good terms. He lived a great life, meaning he lived it his way. Maybe we didn't understand, or maybe some people would have done something different, but not him. He lived it his way, he was happy, and he was creative. I think that's all he really ever wanted to be. And so, I mean, 90 years old, we can only wish.
I wish. I know the way I'm going.
You make it to 90, Mitch, you only got a few.
I don't think I'm going to make it to the end of the week. Honestly, what's your greatest Steve Ditko story that you think of instantly when you close your eyes? What do you see?
When I see Steve Ditko, obviously it's a Spider-Man one.
Yeah.
You know what? You know, okay, this is a strange one, but one of my favorite issues of all time was Spider-Man number 8, which is that old teen angst issue.
Yeah, you like that story. You remember you mentioned that.
I love it. It's that backup story because it's so fascinating. It's a backup story where it's kind of like Spider-Man intrudes on Johnny Storm's party, and it's Jack Kirby's art, but Ditko's inks. And for some reason, in doing Spider-Man, I think it looks so good. I don't know, but it's kind of like Archie meets Spider-Man. And it's just, I love that freaking story. And it's one of my favorite standalone issues ever.
Ever.
And I gotta go with that one. And I gotta go. Spider-Man number 8. If I had to pick any Spider-Man, it would be Spider-Man number 8 because of that story.
The one that everybody always points to is the famous issue. Is it 28 where Spider-Man's being trapped by that building?
I think it's 31, 32, and 33. It could be a number off.
No, what's one where the building's collapsing on him and the water's filling in and he has to lift that?
Yeah, that's like issue 32.
Is it 32? I thought it was 28. But that's a famous page where he's like, you know, I can't give up. I must do this. And then he just lifts it up and there's that full page with him lifting whatever the junk that fell on him, the rafters or beams or whatever.
Yeah, but what makes that so good, just the panels and all that, that basically explains the whole mythos of Spider-Man in just like 4 pages.
Well,
you know, he's under all the mass of the stuff. He's conjuring up like, you know, his Aunt May's going to be sick if he dies.
Yeah. Well, they did that twice in the big movie screen. Did you notice that when they did the original Dr. Octopus Spider-Man fight in the second Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie? He has that building about to fall down on him, and he's trying to save Mary Jane, but he lifts that whole thing up. But I think they did it better in that recent Spider-Man Homecoming movie where the Vulture knocks the entire roof down on Spider-Man, and he's looking down in the water, and you get that famous half Spider-Man face, half Peter Parker reflection in the water. And he's sitting there and he's about to give up. He's like, come on, Spider-Man, you could do it, Spider-Man, come on. And he's, you know, and he does. He just lifts, he finds the inner strength inside of him and he just becomes the hero.
But you got to give Tom Holland great credit. He acted that really good. He put the pressure on him and like it sounded like you could feel like his anxiety and stuff. And I thought that was great. Like you said, come on, Spider-Man, come on.
Yeah. Come on, you know what's another great issue is the annual with the Sinister Six where, like, every battle, the very last page is a giant splash page with him punching Electro and him punching the Sandman and all that.
Yeah, fantastic. That, Sinister Six.
Is that annual number one?
Yeah, annual number one. And why I love those, it's kind of a funny thing. Those Marvel annuals that year, how all the lettering had different colors. It just looks so good.
The lettering had different colors? What do you mean?
Yeah, like the lettering, like the title, like Spider-Man's name was like different colors.
Oh, yeah. I could see it now. Yeah, I do remember. Like the Fantastic Four had that. I never really.
Yeah, it was.
All
it was
the annuals had that year?
Yeah, that was a great.
I never noticed that. Well, I never put them all together, but yeah, you're right. I do remember that.
Fantastic Four Annual 2.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Annual 1. Those are some of the great, because you're talking about standalone issues. That's what an annual meant something like.
Oh, yeah. That was like a year's worth of storytelling in one book. And you're like, this is an epic, you know? Well, yeah, and you know what he would do that was really cool with Spider-Man? Do you ever see, like, he would do the negative Spider-Man costume? Like, it would be black with the webbing reversed out, like he would be in at night?
Oh, yeah. It was so good. And I loved the spider webbing under his arms.
Like, yeah, he was the one that had the wing webs, or the web wings.
I loved that. Oh, I loved it.
And they even said today was a quote I read, Stephen Grant, the writer who was at Terrificon a couple years ago. He did the Punisher series with Mike Zeck. He said, Steve Ditko is not one of the greatest Spider-Man artists. He is the greatest. He's the only Spider-Man artist. And everybody else who's drawn him since then just draws a guy wearing a Spider-Man costume. He said,
you know what?
What?
I think even Johnny Romita would say, I agree. I think so. Because when he took over the title, he didn't know if Ditko was going to come back. And he drew. If you look at those first issues that Romita's doing, he draws like the small panels, almost the claustrophobic panels, the way it was a lot like he was trying to mimic Ditko. And then eventually he got into his own style. But you know what? That's a tough one for me. I can go back and forth on that. Is it Ditko or is it Gil Kane with Romita inks? Because that's the definitive Spider-Man for me. But that, I don't know. I love the Ditko Spider-Man. I that's almost a question I can't answer. I don't know which is better.
Now, what about Doctor Strange? Now, I know Doctor Strange. I would read the books, but I got to be honest with you. I read more of the Roy Thomas later Doctor Strange books with even Steve Englehart's run on it and stuff, more so than the Stan Lee Ditko stuff. Did you read a lot of those?
No, I got to admit, even in the Son of Origins, those books, that's where I first saw Doctor Strange comic, because, yeah, like, they had his origin and stuff, and I even skipped it in there. And now let's fast forward 40, 50 years. Doctor Strange is one of the, he was always like that weird cult character. They always made, like, whether it's costume through the years, even during the 70s when you had the superhero boom, you had a couple of Doctor Strange things here and there, even in the 60s. But he was always kind of like that weird one, and almost like he didn't belong. But fast forward, like I said, 50 years, and now you got a blockbuster movie, and Cumberbatch is absolutely perfect for the role and stuff. And yeah, I loved him. Gotta admit, I loved him in the last Avengers, the Avengers Infinity War. He's one of my favorite characters.
Now, did you follow any of the other books? Did you ever read The Question or
No, because I was such a Marvel zombie, especially at that time. DC didn't exist. Sure, there was a couple of Batman stuff, but I never saw Ditko in those. Like, my brother had a stack of comics in the bottom of his shelf when we were kids, and it was always mostly Marvel. There was a Legion of Superheroes, Superman or Batman, but it was also mostly Marvel, so I never saw much of Ditko then.
Yeah, no. I'm trying to think of other books that I've seen of his stuff. I remember those Marvel Premiere books I'd get in the 80s, the one-offs. Captain Universe was an interesting character. That spun out of the Micronauts book. Dragon Lord. To be honest with you, like you said, in the 80s, I was more of a fan of John Byrne, Mike Zeck, all those artists, George Perez. I really wasn't a fan of the old 60s stuff. It's one of those things. It just happens. I think it's who you're reading at the time you're a kid when you first get into comics. That's the art you adapt to or you grow fond of, and it's hard to change it.
But I agree with you, because, let me see, late 70s, early 80s, John Byrne stuff was phenomenal.
Yeah, and you had that over at DC, you had the Neil Adams, Garcia Lopez, all that type of look on the books.
I loved Lopez. I loved him. It was such a great. I love how they used his art, like, on all the merch, the DC merchandise. It was so concise.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying, though. That's why I was never a fan of the Ditko stuff at the time, because it just seemed so old fashioned.
How old was Ditko then, though? I mean, obviously.
Well, obviously, if he died now at 90, we're talking the 80s. That was 35 years ago now. So he had to be in his late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, well, something
not
like
old, that. Not old,
No, but let's remember, everyone loses a step and all that stuff. You kind of, you know, he wasn't the Ditko he was in the 60s. I mean, he just wasn't. And so look at John Byrne. You said you love John Byrne. Look at his stuff in like the 90s and then the 2000s. You could just see he was losing a step. It just wasn't the same. And everybody does. But I got to admit. So like I said earlier, I saw him in that Hulk annual, and I looked at that. And I was like, this is a horrible Hulk. I was like, ugh, I couldn't do it. And it was Ditko, and that was my first impression of Ditko.
Yeah, and I don't really know much about the Squirrel Girl character to comment on her. I know she's popular now. Like the unbeatable Squirrel Girl, you know.
A cult classic.
How much now you're the guy. Was there a big sale today? I could tell you yesterday I was at the Garden State Comic Con, and I noticed all the dealers had their Ditko books up front, and everybody was buying them. Everybody was buying whatever they can get their hands on. Charlton books, DC, anything with Ditko's work in it, they were picking up. How are things today at the Rain of Flea Market?
Well, let's just say at a comic show, those people are more educated on comics. Now, I'm not saying that there's not a lot of customers, and I have a lot of regulars that come that are. But, and we did talk about Ditko, but no, not really, because the common people that I get there that buy the dollar comics and all that stuff, they're just looking for the characters. And I'll tell you what sells a lot is like the Avengers, Spider-Man, it's those titles. But to be honest with you, no, I didn't. I don't think I sold one Ditko today, and it's kind of strange.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, I thought you would have, because I saw a bunch of people.
But I don't profit on mortality. Let's just, I know a lot of comic stores and a lot of people, like, when the person's dead, they, like, throw that stuff up. Now, I'm not saying that's a great marketing tool, but I'm not really like that. I always go with the flow, and I still have my same stuff. If somebody asks for it, it's right here, and it's right here. But I didn't put it all over my, you know, like the glass tables and all that stuff. I didn't think about it.
Yeah, no, that's you know, it is what it is. But Spider-Man's my favorite character, always. I know people think it's Captain America, but it's always Spider-Man.
It is? Look at, I'm shocked.
Come on. I grew up as a spider, as a webhead, you know, a Spidey fan. He's always my guy. The Captain America we grew up reading in the 70s, 80s was kind of dull. I mean, the best run he had was the Roger Stern, John Byrne run when he was fighting Baron Blood, running for president. And then the Zek series, that was great with DeMatteis. Those were fantastic. I liked that. But then Captain America fell out of it in the 90s. I mean, it was just horrible with that whole Liefeld run. And then, it picked up again.
He became such a Boy Scout.
He did. I mean, I remember the Grunewald series when they tried to make it. Then Wade took it over. And Ron Garney did it, and I was reading them then too. But no, after the mid-90s, I gave up on Captain America. I got to be honest, I didn't come back to him until the Ed Brubaker run where they brought in the Winter Soldier and Steve Epting was doing it.
Let's just throw that out there. That story brought back everybody.
Had Dr. Faustus and Sharon Carter was shooting him and killing him, and the death of Captain America. Those are fantastic books. And then he's pretty much been on a good run. Since then, there was a bit. Arnold Zola was in it, and Arnim Zola. It's all over the place. But anyway, we were talking about Ditko. There's one. I mean, we've met Stan Lee several times. I've met him more of the times than I can count. I've talked to him on an interview once, and shows. And you've met Stan, and you've talked to Stan on the phone and stuff. So, but Ditko was, you know, one of those people that you didn't go bump into. And ironically, you had a correspondence with him with your letter about Ben Cooper. I had written to him about doing a show. And can we just set the story about, before we wrap this up, I mean, how we accidentally encountered the man back in March 2015?
Yeah, okay. The premise is we were at a Comic-Con that went in Times Square.
Big Apple Comic-Con.
Big Apple Con, and we were talking to people, and I think one of us, I can't remember, said like, oh, you know, Ditko lives here.
Well, no. You were talking about your costume. You were, weren't you still going on about the Ben Cooper costume? We had gone on Comic Book Men, radio show, the Mike and Ming show, and you were telling everybody that the costume by Ben Cooper was the original Spider-Man, and that was the inspiration for Stan and Jack and
No, well, I said it could have been. I never said it was, but like, but yeah, but, and then the letter stated like where he lived, and it was right down the street.
Well,
from where
but that's the thing too, because Jack Kirby obviously is dead by now. And Stan Lee, I think you even showed him the costume once, and he didn't really recall anything. And you were like, well, the only other guy that's around that would know anything about this was Ditko. And we were at the convention, and I remember we were talking to Robert Bruce, who was on Comic Book Men, and had the letter. And you said, oh, this is where his offices are, his studio. Maybe, you know, there's a secretary. And it's on a Saturday. Let's make sure people know. It was a Saturday afternoon in March. And we're in Midtown Manhattan, and Rob Bruce says, no, you're an idiot. That's his studio. He doesn't live there. He lives out in Long Island.
And it was kind of strange. And we're like, but I think he does. No. And he's like, it's his studio. And it was like, oh, his studio.
Yeah.
So we go down there, and we get some people, but our inclination was, I think, like, let's go take some pictures in front of his door at his studio. Like, right, let's just get some of those pictures.
Because when we went to the office building, it was an office building. It was, like, doctors and lawyers and an office building, a professional building. And on the legend, when you walked into the lobby, they, you know, when they have, like, which floor you're going to go to, you get your dentist or whatever, it had all the names of the businesses in there. And it said like S. Ditko Studio or something. We were like, oh, look, there it is right there, seventh floor. You know?
Right. And so we go upstairs, and what we do is we take some pictures in front of his door. That's basically kind of what the premise was. And we didn't think anything. And taking pictures, but I think people have to realize we were taking pictures for about 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, easily, because we were like, oh, my God, we're standing on, you know, a landmark here. This is the studios.
Then, even some people got off the elevator.
Remember? Oh, yeah, there was a woman, I remember, she walked down the hall, and she just waved at us. We were like, oh, hi, you know.
Yeah. And so the ending was, hey, let me knock on Steve Ditko's door, and you get a film of me taking that, just to show our, like our homage to him. It'd be kind of funny, I'm just knocking on his door.
Yeah, because at the time we said, oh, there's nobody here, it's Saturday, let's go. And you were like, oh, let me just do it, I'm going to talk to his door. And we're like, yeah, whatever, nothing's going to happen.
Right. And then I knocked on the door, and then lo and behold, he came out. We were all so shocked. And the funny thing is people don't understand is that we respected Ditko. Like, we wouldn't have taken a photo.
Oh, no, no, no. Like I said, it was like, to me, I went to ILM years ago. I went to Skywalker Ranch where they do the Star Wars movies. You don't see George Lucas there. You know what I'm saying? It was like going to Disney World. You don't expect to see Walt Disney himself taking tickets at the door. So that's why it's like, oh, this is his studio. It's a Saturday. It's a business. It's closed. No one's going to be here. You know, I don't go down the street to my dentist's office when it's closed and knock on the door and the dentist opens the door. It's not happening. So that's why we were shocked. So much so, I mean, I jumped a mile. I literally, like, oh, my God.
When that door, yeah. We all did.
And I thought, if there was somebody going to open the door, maybe it's a secretary or something, if there is somebody there, not the man himself.
Right. And then it put us in a precarious position because it looked like we were trying to film him coming out, but that wasn't the case. And so what happens was we were like, oh my God. And we show up, and then he was like, no pictures and stuff.
No, he said, no visitors. And that's what it was.
Visitors. And I was just in shock. And I think I said, can I ask you about objectivism?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what to say because it was just all shocking for all of us.
Oh, yeah, because if I had a list of all the things we were going to talk about, it was the Ben Cooper costume, if he remembered it. You wanted to ask him about objectivism.
Exactly.
But it's like, if you get the opportunity to meet, I don't know, Elvis or Bruce Springsteen or, you know, Neil Armstrong, somebody of that magnitude, what do you say to him? If you have a question, if you have 15 seconds to see somebody of that importance, what would you ask them? Especially if you're a fan of theirs, you know? It's just like, and you didn't know it was going to happen. That's what I'm saying. It's like literally when years ago, I equate this to, they were filming the Indiana Jones movie here in New Haven, Connecticut. And, you know, they had the streets blocked off and they had everything set up for the lights and their stuff. And I'm walking down the same streets that I grew up my whole life. And I turned the corner on Chapel Street to go over to High Street, which is a little area, and there's a pizza restaurant over there. I turned the corner, And there's Steven Spielberg standing there drinking a cup of coffee. And there's Harrison Ford leaning against a tree about 5 feet in front of me. And they're talking about the scene and everything. And I got to tell you, that's what it felt like when Ditko opened that door. I was stunned. I stood there like a deer in the headlights and go, oh my God, what are they doing here? Why? This is surreal. They're actually in front of me. What do I say to them? And that's what it felt like.
Yeah, so was it? It's like one of those things. Like, why did you ask him that? I'm like, I don't even know what the hell.
Yeah, because I remember asking you. I go, that's what you ask him? Can I ask you about objectivism? And you were
yeah. But the thing is, it's like it just popped out. It was kind of like, it's just like all of a sudden you take that turn, like you said, and it just hits you in the face.
Oh yeah, because I've thought about it since, and I always like, what would I have asked him? We didn't know he was going to be there. If we did, we would have been prepared better, you know.
He just wanted the footage of me knocking on the door, but like when he actually showed up, listen, people have to understand too. Is like, we know Ditko, we're friggin' fans, and we know he's not into that stuff.
Yeah.
Well. We didn't go there to film him and like
take. No, we were not trying to take a cheap shot and being an asshole. No,
no, we wouldn't have, because I'll tell you what, I would have rather just friggin' talk to the guy if I knew.
That's what I was saying too. I'm like, why didn't if we knew he was going to be there, I would have taken him to lunch. Honestly, years later, I've always thought about like we went to lunch after that. I'm like, why didn't we just say, hey sir, would you mind very much if we took you out and buy you a salad? Because I heard he was a vegetarian. I would have loved to just sat there with the guy for 5 minutes and bought him a cup of coffee or something, you know?
Yeah, but it put us in a precarious position because you were filming me doing that.
I know. There was a whole thing of you at the door, like, I'm going to knock on his door. And I'm like, he's not here. Whatever. It's like a joke. And then next thing you know, there he was. Boom. Total shock. If you ever saw it, I dropped the camera because I jumped. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I was like stunned.
And when we were leaving, me and our crew, it was just like, oh my God, I can't believe he was there. Like, holy, we were all.
It was like being a kid and walking downstairs and seeing the real Santa Claus. You were like, what? You know?
Yeah. No, but it was almost like you see the real Santa Claus when everybody told you he was fake. And you're like, oh my God, there he is.
And I tell you, even now thinking about it, I remember we walked out of there. We were like stunned. That's all we kept talking about. We got in the elevator like, did that just happen? Did that just happen? Did we? Was that him? And then we started wondering if that was him.
Yeah. Huh? I had such a high. We're like walking on air. It was just like, I remember Kenny was saying to us like, oh my, like he was just like, he looked so like he was so strong. Like, you know, he was like, it was just, we were all mystified and baffled.
Oh, and then remember we were questioning, was that him? We're like,
oh yeah.
Did it look like him? He looked like one of his drawings. He had a little hat on and a little checkered vest and glasses.
Yeah, the other thing is, like you said, it's like it looked like him, and it was like, was it him? Yeah, because it was such a freak.
I was like, it could have been a friend of his that slammed the door on us and said, get out of here. Or we're like, well, who was that, you know?
Yeah, it was an interesting, precarious position. Like, everything wrong that happened, like, happened. I mean, you're filming, I say the wrong thing. Yeah, none of us could even friggin', nobody ever said anything. It was just absolutely crazy.
Yeah, so, no, I just, I, like I said, that was one of the things I'll go to my grave and I'll remember some of the things. I'm bumping into Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg filming a movie. Bruce Springsteen picking up my kid on a stage once when we saw him in Hartford and giving him his guitar pick, and Steve Ditko opening the door in front of us and just staring at us. And I'm like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And so it leaves us to the last part here of like us putting it online and people thinking that, you know, maybe we were trying to take advantage of this. Maybe it was maybe some people perceived it that way. But let me just say that, you know, if we offended anybody, we're sorry, because wasn't our intention. Our intention was, you got to remember,
I think we were trying to show the excitement we had at seeing the man. That's what
let's just be honest here. A lot of people saw what we saw. I got a lot of responses. People loved it and all that stuff. But then we got a few negative responses that it was disrespectful. But we were just trying to show, like, the enthusiasm of seeing that, and we did, and we never released it. That let's friggin' put it up and show people how much we love that. And it was a funny type of situation, and some people got the wrong idea of like we were trying to do that to get likes or whatever. That definitely
wasn't. What? Oh no, God, no, please.
I know.
I'm 52 years old. I can care less about how many likes I have. I'm a grown man, you know.
And let's be honest here. If anybody discredits our credibility to the comic scene. Me and Mitch.
Oh, let's please.
Just say, like, Mitch runs a fucking.
You cut me. Pod. You cut me, like, and I bleed Marvel. You know, I mean, I'm obsessed with this stuff.
No, right, but let's just be honest. You.
Yep.
You,
yep.
You,
yep.
You run a comic con. You, I run a. I'm an agent, and I run a with the big creators, and I run a dealership. Our money is based around these people.
And you know this stuff. Back and forth, I call you up about a book. I go, hey, what's this? And you could just spit it out like you know your own name. That's,
exactly.
Yeah, that's so, how we're into this stuff.
So know? I don't want anybody to think that, once again, we were trying to get Ditko, like, oh, let's film him and knock on the door and film
him.
No.
That would far from it. Like I said, it was pure innocent. Went there, had no idea the man was going to be there on a Saturday in an office building. You're like, what the hell, you know?
And then, so, and because some people took it the wrong way, and then maybe we, like I said, maybe it was in bad taste, maybe we made a mistake. It was never intentional. So we just, for the respect of everything going on,
it's down. You'll never see it again.
I mean, let's be honest. That was a legendary moment for me.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, you know, it was unfortunate that people misconstrued it. And so that's what we have to say. So we apologize to anybody who thought that our intention was malicious or disrespectful anyway, because we love Ditko.
Hey, yeah. I mean, come on. We do a show called The Power Cosmic for over 2 years now, every week, over 100-something episodes, just talking about comic books endlessly.
Yeah.
You know,
so that's how we'll end it. And let's just say we love you, Steve Ditko. Farewell, and have a great great trip to the great beyond. And you know he's doing something up there creative. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, these guys, and once again, another respect factor, there's not many of these core bullpen guys left.
No, there's not at all. The magic, I mean, in the last 5 years alone, half the people I've, or more than, see, I don't know, 80% of the people I grew up reading their stuff, they're gone now. It's very sad.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's throw Harlan Ellison. I mean, he died.
Oh, yeah, Harlan Ellison just died last week. Yeah, that was another
84.
One.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's like we're losing the greats. And, like, everything this industry is based on is on those guys. Stan Lee, Jack Kirby.
Joe Sinnott.
Joe Sinnott, Steve Ditko. All those guys. Chick Stone, even the guys, Larry Lieber. Even
Steranko.
The guys,
yeah, they're all the greats.
Let them get the credit. Thomas and all these guys. And so we love them, and we pay homage to them, and that's what we do. And that's why we do this. Listen.
If the little guy who was reading those comics and when he was 5 years old back in the early 70s thought he could someday grow up and do this, you'd never imagined it. So, all that's based on Spider-Man and all that, and it all came from Steve Ditko. So there you go, full circle.
So we love you, Steve, no matter what anyone says.
Yeah, all right.
All right, Mitch, get us out of here.
And that's
that.
This has been a production of Big Fedora Marketing, LLC. The folks that bring you the terrific Comic-Con, GamerCon, and so much more. Thanks for listening.